Call to order the meeting for the Senate Committee on Education for this day, February 10th, 2015. On my far right.
Which is odd.
Is Representative Lou Frederick, who is visiting today, and I am appreciative of you being here, so thank you for being here, Lou. With that, first announcement, I'll make it at the beginning, at the end of the meeting. At the last meeting, I said that I was going to begin the process of having a work group to talk about OEIB and the bill that we have that has to do with the extension of the sunset. And I'm leaving that open, so if people didn't hear that, they can put their name in. We did get a good list of people, but I just want to make it clear that we're going to try to have a fairly open entry system. We'll talk about that, and I'll look at the numbers as we get going. And then after that, we'll probably meet quietly to try to figure out if there's some things that we can come to an agreement on amongst a lot of people about how we move forward with respect to that organization in our education system. With that, I am going to open an informational hearing, and it is invited testimony only. It has to do with assessment, testing, and education, and we're going to start with about 10 or 15 or shorter presentation by Dr. Nancy Golden, who's the Chief Education Officer, and the work that they're doing right now with respect to assessment.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the Chief Education Officer, and I'm here to talk to you about something that kept me up all night because I was so excited about that. And this is about a new way of looking at assessment. There has been an article on it by Betsy Hammond yesterday. We were also on OPB, and I want to talk to you a little bit about it and the possibility I think it really holds for our students. Fundamentally, I believe this can really change the trajectory for our students, particularly our students in the opportunity gap, because this is really looking at balanced assessment that's really going to focus much more on the formative assessment, what happens every day in a classroom to help children get on track or stay on track or excel, in interim assessment, which is what the teacher uses when they think about, I need to check and see if I need to regroup, add some extra information. So this is really about a balanced system, and I think we've all seen over the last 20 years, the pendulum swing from one side to the other around assessment. I think everybody who is involved in this conversation have great passion for children, but we believe it's gone too far. The big focus is only on summative assessment, and we're not in any way saying we shouldn't have summative assessment, but what we're saying, assessment for learning is really what's going to support kids in moving forward. So I sent you a report. You should have it electronically. And we just hand inside this report, there's actually these recommendations. But I printed them separately because that's where I want to focus today. So I want to talk a little bit about one of the roles of the OEI, the Chief Education Officer, that is really one I really appreciate. And that is going around the state and talking to Oregonians about what's working and what's not working. And one thing I've heard loud and clear is there is an over testing, and everybody seems to be focused on the one-shot test as opposed to the information that really can inform instruction. So given that that was just emerging every place I went, and the governor was hearing it too, he asked us to bring together a group of people who could really do very hard work around reviewing the literature, meeting with nationally known experts, using their own knowledge and voice as teachers, and really start looking at this balanced assessment system. So we had teachers, we had OEA, we had the governor's office, we had Rick Stiggins, who is a national expert, who did all of this just because he knows how important this this balance is. And what we've done is created what we believe is going to be an ideal system. We examined current assessment. We looked at other states. We co-created a vision with some core beliefs, and those core beliefs are actually on page 9 to 11 of the document. But to just give you a sense of them, one core belief is all students can learn and realize their full potential. A second is assessment must support or verify student learning. and that assessment results must inform instructional goal setting. So given this, I think, 19-page document, even bigger, 24 or 25-page document, we worked very hard to come up with a set of recommendations. And those recommendations are in front of you. Just for a general overview, some of these recommendations are policy, some are to systems buildings, and some are really professional development. Before we look at the recommendations, I do want to tell you that this is a draft, and the next stage is to go out to all of our partners. And we really have a list of about 30 partners, but we've already begun to talk to people like OSBA, PTA, OSBA, COSA, Stand for Children, SAVER. We haven't talked to all of these yet, but this is the plan to SAVE Our Schools, Coalition of Communities of Color. We're going to get in and talk to high school students to really get their voice in the room. And then based on that, there will be final recommendations. So this is a draft. This group has met for over a year. They've really put all their heart and soul into this, and I think it has great possibilities. So if you want to look at the recommendation sheet, I could quickly just talk about each recommendation. The one is to really advocate for the reauthorization of ESEA. That's the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So it really reflects what we want it to reflect in terms of what's this balance around assessment. The second one is a student's bill of right. We believe students need to understand why they're taking a test, what's the information the test will tell them, what's the score mean, if I did well, what does that mean, and if I didn't do well, what does that mean, and how are you going to support me if I don't do well, and if I'm not a good test taker, what are the other options I can take in 11th grade to make sure I can demonstrate my knowledge. The third recommendation is that we provide support to make sure teachers, parents have staff development in what's called assessment literacy. We find that a lot of people have different understanding about what do these tests do, what is each test for, and we believe if we're going to have our children sit through tests, people need to really understand the purpose of them so we can use them effectively to help them improve achievement. We want to do an audit of how much time is spent on testing. There's districts already stepping up for this, but what we know is there's the test the federal government tell us to do. Sometimes districts, at the district level, there's more testing, a decision about more testing, and at the building level, there can be a decision about more testing. We want the balance so testing doesn't consume so much time that we don't have the time to actually do instruction. We want to make sure that there is an appropriate bank, assessment bank for formative and interim and assessment so that we teachers along the way can be using formative and interim assessment. We also want to make sure there's an investment in technology. You've probably all heard that so much of the technology we have is consumed by the standardized test. And if that is the case, we also want to make sure that students have an opportunity around assessment. We really want to particularly look at our special ed students and our English language learner students. What we find is in addition to all the other testing they take additional testing to test for their specific needs. We certainly think that needs to be done, but we don't want to be over-testing one particular group. We want to find a smarter way to do that. We really want to look at the feasibility, and this is research. This would be, we don't know what's the right thing, but would it be possible to do more targeted administration of smarter balance? So some people are saying you could take a shorter version of the test. That's one of the notions going on. We just want to look at all the possibilities and see if any of those will still get us where we want to go with it, which is informing the system. We also want to make sure I talk about formative and interim assessments. And in addition to that, we want the opportunity for students who think they're ready to take the test. I might be a ninth grader, but I think I can pass the 11th grade test, that I should have the opportunity to take the test early if I feel like I have the skills to be successful. And the last recommendation, because Smarter Balance is new, because this is the first year we're going to take it, is not to do school rankings with it. We still will have data, we still will have a report card, but we won't be publicly ranking every school. We'll use it to help us provide support to the priority and focus schools. And the second thing is that we want to suspend, in addition to the ranking, for 1 year, attaching Smarter Balance to teacher evaluation, educator evaluation. What the law says is there's multiple measures. We're not saying that student achievement isn't a very important part. It's a critical part of how effective a teacher is, but we're saying we would use these other multiple measures just for 1 year. So those are the recommendations. I'm happy to talk to any of you about them. And it's 2 months that we're giving to really get out around the communities to our stakeholders. And I'm sure there'll be some changes as a result of that.
Yes. Questions, Senator Gelser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's great to kind of suspend using those as accountability measures for both schools and teachers. But I'm wondering a little bit about the students who are the ones that get that score and have that attached to them in a very personal kind of a way. What recommendations do you have to support those kids as they make this transition in their understanding of themselves as learners?
I think that, Senator Gelser, thank you very much. I think that's a critical question. We sort of thought, based on not ranking schools, it wouldn't create additional pressure, but I think that's one of the suggestions we have to look deeply into. In addition to those, we could say for students, you know, at least we really get clear with them what the score is and that it's the first year. So I'll take that as input. Thank you.
Follow-up, yes.
I have kids that are taking the Smarter Balance. I know the middle school that my daughter is in may have an unprecedented number of model bills in their mock Congress to get rid of standardized testing, because they're they're pretty frustrated with the time. But I think kids don't spend a lot of time thinking about the school ranking. They think about that number that comes
right
back assigned to them as it rates to a cut score. And for some kids, they really do take that in a very profoundly emotional way that really impacts the rest of their learning and how they approach school and whether they feel comfortable being there. So I guess just the caution is, if we're nervous about the impact on the perception of the well-being of our school systems and we're concerned about the impact on teacher evaluations, I think we should probably be concerned about the impact on children who it impacts the very most.
Absolutely, I totally agree with that. One recommendation I did forget to cover is just to enhance and expand options for students who don't demonstrate, whose talents aren't to demonstrate essential skills through Smarter Balance. We know in certain school districts, school districts really put out there all the options, and I've heard kids say, I didn't know I had other options. So that's really critical to us, but I'm also hearing what you're saying about that, so I appreciate that.
Other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Now we're going to invite Dr. Yung Zhao, who's the Presidential Chair and Director of the Institute of Global and Online Education, College of Education, University of Oregon. And just a short statement. Last summer, the Coastal Caucus has a economic summit on the coast, and we had decided that one of the education should be a part of that conversation, and Dr. Zhao came, and I think lit up the audience with ways to think about things that we hadn't done before. So I felt it would be important at that time. I asked him if I could get the chair at that time to be willing to have an informational meeting. Would he be interested in coming? He said yes instantly, and it was difficult when I found out he came today by airplane from wherever he was back into the state and got here just before this meeting. So I want to say I appreciate your willingness to be here, your intellect, and it's nice to have people who are thinking profoundly about a lot of these issues in our state. So thank you for being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. Thank you for all the committee members and all the friends here. It's, I just want to first let you know that I'm from China. I actually, Oregon was my first home in the U.S. I came here in 1992. Then I've been traveling around this the U.S. I was lived in Illinois. I lived in Michigan 15 years and in New York. I came back to Eugene about 4 years ago. So this is great, and I'm very happy that you guys are taking care of Oregon very well. And so first off, I really want to chat a little bit about, you know, we talk about assessment and we talk about curriculum. My biggest concern is really what makes our children successful, what makes Oregon successful in the long run. My comments are drawing really from research from globally, different policies, different countries, different systems, and of course different states in the state, in the U.S. And I want to start really by talking about what's the purpose of education? You know, I think now the one phrase that we everybody use a lot is called college and career readiness. And that's what the Common Core, Smarter and Badness. And then when I look at the data, is college readiness really a valuable goal, for example? I'm not challenging college. I'm just thinking about what kind of college that matters. And I just want to let you know that I have children as well. I have a daughter, as you can see her. That's, she's going to trying to go to college. You probably cannot see her. And so let's look at this thing. What does it mean to be college ready? And but then I look at the data. Recent college graduates in the U.S. right now, about 53% of college graduates are not fully employed. They're either underemployed or unemployed in the U.S. And so we have created what I call a boomerang generation in the U.S., you know, like the Australian boomerang, you throw them away, they come back. And so that's the of my big concern. And for my children, I set a goal for them. I said, you know, doesn't matter what you do, but once you go to college, as long as you can stay out of my basement, that's success. what I'd like to see, it's not about college readiness, it's about out of the basement readiness. So that's what so that's how I've been trying to think about education. If you look at the data, this is quite scary data. You know, this is, by the way, 2014 data did not change much, even though national unemployment rate has dropped a lot. And it's also a global problem. That is, China now, for example, graduates 7 million college students a year. That's graduates almost two Oregons. It's a lot of them annually. And Australia's youth unemployment hit 12-year high. I was just in British Columbia. British Columbia as a government, the province, is redesigning their whole education system. They brought me in and a lot of people from different countries trying to think about different strategy. And, of course, European countries have a youth unemployment problem. Korea just hit high. Over 90% of them now youth are college graduates. Their president said, just skip college. Just go do something else. And China just last, this is unprecedented. Two months ago, the government said, told college kids, suspend your study, go start a business. Because there's no hope for you guys, and there's no employment. This is a fascinating trend now in worldwide. And why is that? Because at the same time, we're seeing an increasing number of businesses are asking for qualified candidates. You know, we outsource a lot of jobs, and one of the reasons we say we do not have qualified candidates. But that's actually the same case in about right now, about 80% of the major economies are saying that they do not have enough talents. So you have a talent surplus, you got a talent shortage. And eventually what we analyze is that it's called a talent mismatch. That is, our education is, we did not poorly prepare our children. We prepared them for the wrong society. The society that doesn't exist anymore. So if education continues to do that, the more we do it, the perhaps farther away we're going to move out. So I want to use an analogy. I don't know how many of you still use a Nokia phone. Do you still use a Nokia phone, any of you? You don't? Really? Okay. Remember Nokia was very, I don't know, I'm going to show you this Nokia just in case. Just remind you what it was like, Nokia phones. I have a lot of Nokia phones here. This is all the history of Nokia phones. And it's going to come out. Nokia phone. You know, remember some of these phones?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, good. So Nokia was the largest cell phone maker in 1990s. It was the major industry of Finland, and now Finland has lost it. It's sold Microsoft, killed it, and now Finland now lives on Angry Birds, by the way. And that's this is fascinating. So people are asking in business, who killed Nokia? And people say, of course, it's iPhone. You know, if you look at iPhone, when the iPhone came out, and the industry, the profit just flipped. Nokia lost, and iPhone came up. But more analysis would say that Nokia killed Nokia, because Nokia was trying to sustain its old platform of making a dumb phone smarter. They're adding smartphone features to a stupid phone. And Apple came up with a smartphone. That's the add of the phone business. So that's a big shift. So when you think about education reform, are we doing the wrong thing more right, or are we actually doing the right thing? In the U.S., if you look at over the past 30 years, and actually it's even previous to Bill Clinton, you know, the Charlottesville Summit, that's one of the first 1989 major federal efforts in this whole thing, after a nation at a risk in 1983. And that's former President Bush, the father Bush, and it was talk about, at that time, ever since then, they've been talking about increasing standards, more testing, more accountability, more STEM. That's what we've been doing over the last 30 years. So if you look today, the Common Core is really a continuation, a realization of that. And under No Child Left Behind, of course, the ESEA, that's, you know, formed a newer version. And under Race to the Top, a Common Core, commas, all of them is the essence, I would say, to make a stupid phone smarter without shifting this whole thing. They're still fixing something. And let me just use some of the data to show you that why it doesn't work in the past. Because right now we're still trying to fix the curriculum, fix the assessment, fix the teachers. That's what our efforts are. You look at all the major reforms are trying to do that. First of all, let's think about how do test scores predict an individual's past or future? That's one thing. Why do we care about test scores so much? All this one, we use test scores to hold teachers, students, parents, and schools accountable. So it should mean something. And now, what does it mean? You know, that in this country, we're driven by two test score gaps that scared us. One is called the domestic achievement gap. That is, there's gaps between certain racial groups, economic groups. Another one is called the global achievement gap, saying that our country, our average Americans preparing worse students than others. So do their rainy test scores mean anything? Let's take a look at some of the old data, and I'm going to show you. So let's look at individuals. Do they matter? And a long time ago, people did a lot of study of individuals. So I'm going to start with individuals. I will start with my own group. We call them model minorities. By the way, that's a racist term that's created in the 1950s to deny the existence of racism in the U.S. to say, look at the Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, they can make it. Why can't you make it? That's a denial. That's a racist term. But it's continued to be used. And let's refer to the kids. They're called model minority kids, especially East Asian kids and Indian kids. If you look at any statistics, test score-wise, all the Asian group outscore other racial groups, you know, consistently all the time. That's why you have the book called the Tiger Mom book. Remember the Tiger Mom book a while back? So the Asians, they score better. And by the way, this is a global trend. They score better in England, they score better in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, and you can see this 5% of U.S. population Asians right now, but with 15 to 25% of them enrolled in Ivy League schools. And they, of course, 24% at Stanford, 46% at Berkeley, and actually, you know, Los Angeles, UCLA, you know, has even more. That's why I call it UCLA. It stands for UCLA, lots of Asians. That's that's what it is. What's interesting, you said this one, is that the Asians are not very happy. Because they look at the actual life achievement, they are much less than most other groups. 2% of the Fortune 500 board seats are Asians. They don't even get close to the stellar accomplishment academically. As Wellesley Young, a Korean American, who has wrote an article in the New York Times, talk about, these are not real tigers, they're paper tigers. So they don't really work very well. So that's just one side of the story. But if you look at some more studies, since 1920s, by the way, tests have always used almost like a racist tool. The IQ test introduced from in 1916, and that was used to actually exclude certain groups from immigrants into this one, excluding Southern Europeans, because they measured in the U.S. Army and after World War I, showing that they were of lower IQs. So they were trying to have immigration quota based on that. And this was used to justify eugenics, all those things. But so the longest study using IQ was by Lewis Terman, a Stanford psychologist who introduced IQ test to this country. In 1920s, and this study actually continues, it's still falling, almost 100 years old. There are few people still left from that original group. He recruited about 1,500 students from California, about 13-year-olds at that time, and their IQ score were above 135, which is the top 1% of our population. And he followed them all the years, and he died, and people still follow. The study still goes on. If you can go, there's a lot of data at Stanford. You can go track them down. But one thing they found after about 35 years of the study, you know, middle-aged people, so are they very successful? So this is supposed to be the first very scientific longitudinal study. And you're going to find out it's about... these people had better academic achievement. 2/3 of them got a bachelor's degree. They had better income. On average, it's about twice of the national average of white-collar jobs in 1954. And also had better careers, like 87 PhDs, 57 MDs, and 92 lawyers. And they were seems to be creative, produced a lot of scientific papers and patents as well. But later on, people discovered these are impressive, but not that impressive, they said, you know. And their productivity in patents, novels, writing, scientific papers were half of their other same kind of same quality scientists at that time. So not that impressive. And another funny thing is that out of the 1,500, the smartest people, there's no Nobel Prize winner in this group. And there are two Nobel Prize winners did not make it. So they found two people were just, their test scores didn't go that far. Shockley, the guy who started Silicon Valley, won Nobel Prize. He was excluded from the study because his high score was not high enough. And of course you have there's a Harvard sociologist talk about, theoretically, anyone, he said, if you randomly draw anybody from the same backgrounds, it would produce the same results. So yes, it's not because of IQ scores, it's because of the family backgrounds. If you look at that in the 1920s, in this whole 1,500 people, they only have 2 African-Americans, 6 Japanese-Americans, and 1 American-Indian. All the rest are white, middle-class, urban Californians. So in essence, they said, they were trying to say, this study did not prove that IQ, one test score, mattered. And then we have now today, everybody talks about SAT and SAT. They're supposed to predict your college success. And this is, remember when we talk about today, the Smarter and Bannon's, Park, all those tests were testing young kids. Now we're actually talking about even later studies, high school, you know, senior years, junior years, SAT and SAT scores, they do not predict college success. And this is the study, for example, 1998, USA system, the California system, University of California system, basically showed about 13% of the variation are explained by SAT scores. 13%. And you go to College Board, the one who sells SAT, and the meta-analysis showed about the same thing, about the correlation is much lower than the GPS. By the way, I'll be happy to supply all this data to you, and it's written up in other places as well. And SAT has the same thing. And most recently, last year, as you may be aware, there's about 800, an increasing number of colleges and universities in the U.S. have made standardized testing optional. an essay to SAT, so you can apply with or without submitting a study. Started by Bates College in Maine, and the Bates College admissions dean did a study of the over 123,000 students in over 30 different kind of institutions, found that those who submitted a test score, SAT or SAT, and those who did not submit, there's no difference in their college performance or graduation rates. And in fact, it is claimed that a lot of first-generation colleges, college students do not submit on minorities because they were consistently scored lower on standardized tests in minority groups. So this actually would enlarge our pool and bring more candidates in. And so this is, we call this personal, individual success. If test scores as such, we spend so much money, so much time, people even prepared for this, did not predict individual success, we should not expect to predict any more than that. So that's the one thing. Well, another area I want to address is, do they predict country success? Because we're so worried about other countries become successful than us based on test scores. So many of you may be very concerned or have heard a lot from the federal government about how American education is in decline, is getting worse every day. That's why we're doing all these reforms. I can tell you from examining history of American test scores, if test scores were an indication of quality of education, I would say that American education is not in decline. It's not getting worse. It has always been bad. It's been bad for a long time. It's been horrible. If, I want to show you the some of the data, not all of this, but if you look at 1960s, 1964, the first international mathematics and science study, Americans 12th graders ranked 12th out of 12 countries. That's our beginning. And you can't get it worse than that. So when people say we're getting worse, there was never a good old day in education for America. Never. In 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, year 2000, all this data I would say in terms of ranking, we have been horrible. And also some of you may recall, even before that, 1958, that's the year, by the way, after 1957, when Soviet Union launched Sputnik. Sputnik woke up the country and justified the intrusion of the federal government in education through something called NDEA, the National Defense Education Act. Because the federal government tried to do something with education, which is state right, they couldn't do it unless it's national defense. And, of course, it's quite absurd. Education is national defense. We still come talk about that. But at that time, Life magazine had a cover story to show how much worse American education was compared to that of Soviet Union. As you can see from the two kids there, one is from Chicago, Stephen, and another is from Moscow, Alexei. If you flip through the pages, by the way, you can find them online right now. It's kind of fascinating to see and to show this. The same argument started then, said we have worse math standards. Our children are having too much fun, basically that's Americans' problem. And I have to tell you, as update, Alex, by the way, after the Cold War came to the U.S., actually, and Stephen became an engineer. He's fine. This is the story. So if America has been bad as education for so long, how come this country is still here? That's another story. So if you look at, by the way, I was going to show you, UK has never performed better either, so we can kind of good brothers. But so this is according to President Obama. America still has the largest, most prosperous economy in the world. Most workers are more productive than ours. No country has more successful companies. Actually, this is true. Remember, we said this in 2011. That's just right after the financial crisis. U.S. was actually bad at that time. 2014, we have regained a lot more. So this is, the countries we use, we glorify, have almost practically disappeared. Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. Japan, which in the 1990s, which we learned from Japan, Japan's economy has not gone well. And China's economy is practically stalled right now. So the whole thing, how come, what happened? How come this test scores didn't mean anything? This is when it comes to my second point about what really matters. I think education, we all want outcomes. We want outcomes for our own children, want outcomes for the nation, for the state. We should really look for outcomes that matter. Outcomes that matter. What outcomes matter? And I'm just going to show you one piece of data for you to think about. I've been tracking one of the things about is this idea of scores versus other qualities. In 2003, that's 12 years ago, and TIMSS called Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study. As usual, American students, fourth graders and eighth graders, scored way below Asian kids. Singaporeans, Japanese, Koreans, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China did not participate, mainland China. But all these standardized tests, these international assessments, they have always another measure. It's called the non-cognitive measure. For example, confidence, interest, value. And you might expect American students, you know, we're not really good, but we're very confident. You know, so American students, we out-confident everybody. It's, that might explain some of the stuff. It's been if you look at this data, it's just not one time. That's not one time. It's actually a consistent data. For example, in 2011, I'm going to show 2011 data, the same study, international study. If you look at the top five countries, they're all East Asian education systems, and their students outscored Anglo-Saxon original countries, we call US, UK, Australia, by 100 points. But if you look at the second column, confidence, Korean students of 3% are confident, and by the way, Singapore actually went up a lot because Singapore has been reforming its education system a lot. So, and if you look at, across countries, we see a negative correlation between confidence and math scores. So this is, that means countries with high math scores have lower confidence and students enjoy math less. And this is not only in TIMSS. There's another big study called PISA, the Program of International Assessment of Student Assessment Programs, operated by OECD. And that's, by the way, the OECD, the PISA group, is trying to sell that to every state in this country. They're trying to make sure every state adopt that. Again, that's a huge mistake. But I want to show you this one. On the PISA, Finland came out to be number one on the first rounds. It measures 15-year-olds, mainly in three domains, math, reading, and science. They've added problem solving. And Finland was number one twice in science. But the Finnish government was deeply concerned that their children are not interested in science. They said if they're not interested in science, they're not likely to become a scientist. So they have high scores, low interest. PISA is showing the same thing. And that is the scores always negatively correlate with other attributes. And then I took this study. I said, okay, I'm going to look at another measure. This so-called entrepreneurship measure. This is something called a global entrepreneurship monitor, which tracks entrepreneurial activities in different countries. And if you look at that, the result is that countries with higher PISA scores have lower entrepreneurial confidence, lower entrepreneurial activities, and in actually all categories. So this, at least, is partially evidence to show that test scores do not predict a country's future. This is also why, while Asian, we are so worried about our test scores, all Asian countries and are deeply concerned about their students' lack of confidence, enthusiasm, and interest. And because they believe that's what's going to drive the creativity and entrepreneurship that we need. So I was thinking when I was sitting here, I said I came out of China, I tried to run away from a country that's over-testing, Now I landed into one that's over testing, and I said maybe I should have never moved here now, because China now is trying to reduce testing. China actually began to ban testing at elementary grades. China just started a new reform last year. Reform, it's even notorious. College entrance exam, right now they're trying to emulate American system, look at multiple indicators for person success. Korea did this 4 years ago, and you will see that many other countries do this. So let me go back to say this. What does all of this mean to us as education professionals to think about what we need in the future? Why aren't our children out of our basement? That's, I'm going to go back there again. It's because that's what explained the past. But the future hold something even more different. I started by saying that we have a talent mismatch. So why do we have a talent mismatch? This really has a lot to do with technology change. As we all know, when technology changes, it redefines what's valuable, what's not valuable. Literacy became important only after Gutenberg invented the printing press, made everybody wants to read. So I always blame our illiteracy problem on Gutenberg. And you can, but just think, let me give you another little example. I don't know if you are aware of this. This is the Google car. The Google car is coming perhaps to Oregon. I don't know if unless you stop it. It's a driverless car, a car that does not need a human driver. Can you imagine the kind of jobs that would disappear after this? This not only taxi drivers, bus drivers, truck drivers, police. Because now you can drink and drive and nobody would arrest you. Think about, by the way, that we're going to sell a lot of Willamette Valley wine. That's another possibility. Think about this. This is, it's amazing. It's a lot of drivers add or disappear. You got all these traffic lights might change. Because, you know, all this infrastructure was built to serve the human driver. When you do not need a human driver anymore, laws will change, insurance companies, they all major change. So what has happened over the last 30 years in this world? There are two big things that has changed. One is we call the arrival of the second machine age. This is a book by two MIT computer scientists. They wrote, the first machine age was created by the steam engine, which caused industrial revolution, which made farming not very essential anymore. Farming, I mean, essential, but not require so many people. So that's a major revolution. Now we have another revolution, the digital revolution. The digital revolution, as you might have experienced, deals with our cognitive functions, directly with education. Directly with education. As a result of the digital revolution, we see a massive shift in terms of our jobs. And Michigan, you may remember Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rust Belt had a lot of middle class jobs like this until about 1970s. Today, all the jobs were gone. That's it. And this is all this replaced millions of jobs. And also, digital technology does not only replace assembly line jobs. It's replacing lots of white-collar jobs. I remember when I first came here in the 1990s, and around tax season, you go to a shopping mall, you can see those so-called tax accountants sitting there doing tax for you. Remember those times? I think, but now they disappeared. Those jobs went to TurboTax. You know, unless you're making a lot of money, you don't need to hire a tax accountant. And we're seeing the transformation in medicine as well. Technology replaces a lot of jobs. We need a different kind of medical profession. And in the U.S., we actually now, this is ironic, but it's funny, it's true. We have a surplus of lawyers. You know, America, but it's still possible. Okay. We're still suing each other as much as possible, but we just don't need as many lawyers, simply because digital databases, we can search now. So this change, we still haven't seen the end of it. But we've lost a lot of routine jobs. Whatever schools prepared kids for, these jobs are either replaced by machines or they're outsourced to other countries. That's what we call the second factor, the arrival of the global age. Globalization reduces transaction cost of jobs. Jobs can be done anywhere. So the talent is a global market. If they can purchase the same talent skills in a country that cost less, the job will go there. And then there's another issue with America, though. That's why the international testing doesn't make sense. America spends, on average, as a nation, $115,000 per student for 12 years, public school. China spends about $10,000. India is less. So if we spend $115,000 per pair of students for the same skills, they do not deserve to have a job, if you think you're using hard economical terms. So we better be doing something else. So even if we could educate our kids to match the test scores of Chinese, Indians, Japanese, Vietnamese and options popping up as well, we're not going to have a job. Now, that's why our students are back in our basement, because they were educated for economy that does not exist anymore. We need a new economy. A new economy is exemplified by this very well. This is the job changes over the past 200 years. You can see that start 1800, we see a dramatic decline of farming, forestry. I think Oregon just gone through that, timber industry. When I was in Michigan, we had a lot of timber. We cut down. We had mining. We had copper. That's gone. We had auto. That's gone. Michigan is in trouble right now. I mean, so that's where Oregon, we go through the same problem. And then replacing that were we call working class, people employed by mass big companies. Now, that's declining since 1970s because of outsourcing and digital technology. So what do we see on the rise? The two classes, the creative class and the service class. And this is what reflects our current economic situation in this country, a bipolar growth. And that's why we're seeing the disappearance of the middle class in this country. Middle class jobs are gone. We're seeing the affluent group going, growing high, and low income group. This is called bipolar growth of U.S. economy. If you go to Silicon Valley, you will see this very well. The ones work for Google, and the ones work for Facebook, they're growing very well. All the service sector is growing very well. Now, as a nation that's built on the middle class, how do we regain the middle class? So what will the middle class be? Well, the middle class cannot have the same skills that can be replaced by machines or can be done cheaper overseas. And what would that be? There are several things, you know. One, that's why we need an education transformation. So number one, we need to think about this. What do technology bring us? We need to make something disappear, it makes something more valuable. This is always the case. You know, when those people replaced by those robotics, people who make robotics gain jobs. Imagine the Google car, we would be not need a driver, we may need more car interior designer, because now you can drink, you can take a hot bath, you know, before you go to work. And when a lot of people design the interior stuff, right? So it's also, we need to think about not holding on to the past, but inventing the future. So what does the future mean? Well, there's a lot of research showing this, but one area, Daniel Pink calls that, we have arrived at the age of abundance. What does age of abundance mean? In the age of abundance means we consume things that's not necessary for physical survival. We consume wants and desires. What we want, that's called spiritual and psychological products. And this is why what I see, traditionally useless people have become useful. Traditional useless people have become useful. You may disagree, but I want to give you an example of Kim Kardashian. Traditionally useless people. You will say, Kardashian represents a class I call celebrity for nothing. Celebrity for nothing. She's a celebrity. Yep. She's for nothing.
Yep.
She's famous for being well known. That's all she has. What does she represent? This is actually fascinating. Look at her. How come she's not in her parents' basement, first of all? Okay? She's prepared her parents' basement. And there's a whole class of this. Look at all our, how many TV channels you watch, how many cooking shows you have, how many movies we watch today, how many books we read, 26 million songs on iTunes. Do we need all of those things? No. We may actually, you may not like Kardashian, but there's enough people like her to make her worth $40 million. Okay, it's enough people. Psychological products are diverse. All of us are guilty of consuming this. Because in the age of abundance, we consume psychological, spiritual, and everything that's not tangible. I'll give example of this. When you don't like Kardashian, you'll like my next example, because I came to this Linfield College as a visiting scholar in about 1992. When I first arrived in Portland, you know, I came from China directly. I went to this shop trying to buy something, wash my hair. Couldn't do it because I did not know what kind of hair I had. Oily, normal, or dry. I had one bar of soap for everything. That was fine. Okay. Now, why do you have so many choices? Americans consume choices. You know, if you can come up with a choice, you love it. You know, everything will have a choice. Look how many flavors you have of potato chips. It's shocking. And then you go to a restaurant here, I'm sure you do this. The more food, the more money you spend, the less food you get. Another thing, a necessity. I came from a village. We grow grass for the water buffalo. Here you grow grass to cut it at the end of the month. And you have to do that. This is shocking to think about. We have arrived at a different time. We consume psychological, spiritual products. Spiritual products are, in essence, much more diverse, human desires. Therefore, we have so many channels. Today, the U.S. entertainment industry is larger than auto industry. It's larger than the auto industry. I'm not advocating for all of this because all of you want it. Remember, you buy an iPhone, you change it every 2 months and 2 years, and you have to buy a cover to go with it. I mean, what's the purpose of that? How much money is Facebook? What do we do with Facebook? We waste our time on it. That's all we do. So I'm saying that we have arrived at a different time. We consume different products. So the first lesson I learned from this, if Kim Kardashian is useful, anyone can be useful. Therefore, in our schools, we cannot continue to define what's more valuable, what's less valuable. The Common Core and all the traditional curriculum, they actually is discriminatory. They're discriminating against other talents. There's talents, the reading, math are what I think important, others not important. That's not true anymore. You watch Super Bowl, all these football players, how much money Super Bowl was? $500 million an event. FIFA soccer games, you look at talents, what kind of talents they had? I mean, like 100 years ago, they're perhaps not very valuable. There's a violent kids kick around in the village, and that's not very useful. And so that's something I think we cannot discriminate against talent. You know, that's number one thing. And to those talents, for example, give another example, dyslexia has been considered a deficit for a long time because it interferes with reading. Dyslexia is a form of neuron condition that interferes with 2D spacing, so you cannot read very well. But then modern research, actually this last 10 years, we discovered, scientific research shows, this kind of neural wiring gives you great talent in 3D spacing and visual imaging. So it makes you a great artist and astrophysicist. Great art and so forth. Now, there's reason for this. 100 years ago, if you're good at this, there's no job for you. Remember this? There's not many people consume art. Today, not more people consume art. Everybody consumes art, and there was no job in astrophysics. Remember 100 years ago? This is dramatic shifting. What's asset, what's deficit, is changing a lot. And I have to confess to you, you know, when I was born in this village, this Chinese village, in my village, the common core was to ride a water buffalo. You know, parents assess me, can you drive a water buffalo very well? And I was not very good at that. So that's why they got rid of me. I had to go away, go to Oregon. That's how. So in our education, when we define core subjects, are we judging our students by their deficit? So that's number one thing we need to think about. Number two, you can have special talent, but that's not of no value unless you become creative. Attach a creativity element to it. Because you can have talent, but you're not good enough, there's no value. And most of things so far have been created. You have to be able to combine, like Paul Romer, a Nobel laureate in economics of Stanford, said, the new value comes from creating by combining existing things. In a bag of flour, bag of brown sugar doesn't mean much, but you can make a beautiful cake. It adds value to that. People can combine. So we've been talking about creativity today. We think creativity is of great value now. But creativity as a new concept is only mentioned after 1920s. People did not really value creativity. Remember, creativity means deviation. Creativity means being original. It means you do not comply. And that's why if you look kids like this, you don't like kids like this. Yeah. This kid will not be kindergarten ready in this state. And by the way, there are nearly 30 states now in this country trying to do kindergarten readiness, which I think is an absurd concept. Kindergarten should be ready for me, for my child. Why would the kid would be ready for, and you test them. And I saw this test in this assessment standard in Maryland. They said one of the standards, you would find this interesting, said one of the standards for kindergarten readiness is being able to walk in a straight line. I thought that's what you do when you get caught. You got to think about that. And another standard. That was funny. It's not really. They said being able to stay awake during the day. That's kind of readiness. So we don't like deviant kids. And that's why you look at all of us, all children are born to be extremely creative. Age 5, 98%. Of our children at age 5 are creative at a genius level. This is based on one measure called the divergent thinking measure, 98%. After 5 years in our schools, we've successfully got rid of 60% of them, 32% left at age 10. It gets worse. Five more years, age 15, 10% are left. And after you go to college, you become a good employee. Age 44, 2% left, and hope comes after retirement. You could you could regain your creativity. Why is that? It means creativity is not only cognitive. Creativity is psychological. Do you think you can be creative? And testing works against that. Testing rewards compliance. Testing rewards your ability to find the answers fast. Testing tells you, if you give me what I want you to do, you get good grades. Testing do not reward asking questions, challenging those things. Look at our schools. We call the global third and fourth grade creativity slump. You ask, okay, if you go to any kindergarten, first, second grade, I think, Senator Geiser, you know that you have children, you know this. About third, fourth grade, they drop very quickly because they become good students. They become very good students. And this actually is fascinating. PISA claims to test problem-solving skills. Singapore scored number one last year. I was in Singapore. I was talking to the Minister of Education and was speaking to about 1,000 teachers in Singapore last April. They just scored number one, so they're very proud. So asking one question, I said, well, you're good at solving problems, at least taking a problem-solving test. But do you know what problem is worth solving? Does that matter more? Being able to ask questions might matter more, but nobody measures that, those kind of things. So this is the danger of creativity we lose. And then one final point is that not only that, but also we have to think about another level of thinking. That the third element is what we call entrepreneur thinking, entrepreneur abilities. That is today, on average, U.S. right now lose about 3 million jobs every year. Everyone lose. Companies die. That's what. But luckily, we have companies come up with new jobs. Those are called startups, entrepreneurs. We create new jobs. So today, we have to think about how do we create new jobs? We can't continue to educate job finders, job seekers. We have to educate job creators, from employees to entrepreneurs. And today, the idea of entrepreneurs have expanded. By the way, I verified with a French guy, he said I'm right. So okay, and this word does come from France. Unlike President Bush said, the French doesn't know what entrepreneurship means. But anyway, this is a French word. Okay, and what it means today, entrepreneurs have expanded to mean business entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, the nonprofit organizations, because in the traditional charitable way, it doesn't work anymore. You have to think about this. If you donate shoes to Africa, you start a shoe company. You donate every 10 pair you sell, one pair goes there. That's you want to save the environment. It's more entrepreneur activities. We also need intrapreneurs, entrepreneurs working within the organization. Best example is those two guys, Jim Fry and other guy who invented the Post-it note from 3M. Google has 20% in the time. That's called esteemed entrepreneurs. Apple Computer will tell you that if you want to be managed, you're not employable. They want entrepreneurs. Google today has 14% of employees without college credentialing. Actually, Google does not look at which college graduate. They look at, are you able to create and imagine, come up with new ideas? We call them intrapreneurs. And of course, we need people like you, policy entrepreneurs, people who are creative in policy making, who are able to negotiate. And so what's the difference between an entrepreneur and employee? Entrepreneur wants to solve problems. Employee follow directions. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs say things through. Entrepreneurs take crisis as opportunities. Entrepreneurs do not look lack of job as a problem, look at as opportunity to recreate. Oregon, the U.S., all our children back in our basement all need that skill. And what makes that skill, you can say, the entrepreneurial qualities. We all can have this. This is what we call, some people call this soft skills. Some people call them non-cognitive skills. Whatever you call them, I actually think they're human skills. You need to have confidence. You need to have friends, social intelligence. Collaboration is not sufficient. Collaboration may be a skill, but social intelligence, friends, matter a lot more. It's you know who you want to collaborate with. And think about being able to take risk, have passion, you know, all these things. So this is where we miss. We can't measure all of it. I just finished a book. If you want to read, I can send you the whole book. It's very long, but it's called Counting What Counts. I try to review, can we really measure all of those things? Do we know how to measure? I tell you, it's extremely difficult. And some ones, as soon as you measure it, you reduce it. This is the irony of measurement, of testing. So just want to kind of try and end for us to consider is that one more thing is talk about this, is that we... In education, we don't talk a lot about medicine. But in medicine, one major thing we always say is about called side effects. When you go buy Tylenol, it cures your runny nose and headache, but might cause a bleeding stomach. I don't know, you guys don't read that, right? You should read it, but it's serious. In education, have we thought about concept of side effects? I was basically showing Asian countries have seen the side effects. Overtesting, high test scores, results in lack of confidence. Some early reading programs, I can responsibly tell you because I used to be involved in early reading research, they should come up with a warning label. This may raise your test scores on oaks, but might cause your children to hate reading forever. Which one would you rather have? Side effects. That's something we need to consider. So when we look at, when we celebrate achievement in one area, we should always ask, what did we lose? Did we lose something? So I believe in the future, the next paradigm, instead of making the Nokia phone smarter, if you want to invent the iPhone of education, what would it be? It's a very simple model I've suggested in my last book. The model would be, talk about new paradigm. It is not about homogenizing people. It is about enhancing people. Right now, we try to homogenize. We try to make everybody similar. We measure them. Today, our education is called education of the average. We define children by their deviation. If you deviate on top, you are gifted. If you deviate at the bottom, you go to special ed. And we measure them based on two subjects, math and reading. That's it. We don't think about other talents. So how about we start education not by prescribing a better curriculum, better assessment, but we follow the child. There are successful education models doing this one. What if in this country, when we spend so much money, our measure is not to compete with other countries in test scores, but in how well we personalize our education. If every child, no matter what background they come from, comes supported to develop his or her passion to the level of greatness, attach a spirit of creativity and entrepreneurship, we might actually just get there. And the final thing is that all of this we have to realize, Oregon is in a great position. We are facing the Pacific Ocean, the Asia, you know, continent, the Asian age is right here. So we have to think about global competence. Our Oregon, I can assure you, it's just trying to say, we're not going to become a great state if we try to compete with Idaho, how well we test better than them. You know, we have to be very uniquely positioned. You know, not only every child has to be unique, every district, every teacher have to go there. So I suggest we think about an entrepreneur-oriented education. Thank you.
Thank you. So, question?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I mean, I think this is the third time I've listened to your presentation, and I get more out of it every time. I think what really hit me this time was your statement, it's not about getting kids ready for kindergarten, it's about getting kindergarten ready for kids, which I thought was absolutely brilliant and on point. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator.
Other questions? I guess what I want to say is thank you again, because there has not been a time that I've heard you that you haven't made provocative thoughts come. And thanks for making the rest of them, who all know that I'm dyslexic, understand that I do have
how brilliant you are.
I do have some attributes that are better these days than they used to be. But the reality is, I think as we endeavor in any of this education stuff to not really look out and try to figure out where we want to be and what we're doing is a real problem that we have faced many times in the past. And I haven't met anyone who articulates that better than you have, so I appreciate very much having you here and your time, and we will try to keep in touch.
Thank you.
And we may find whatever those books are that you have, and we can make a list for our people if they are interested in getting some. We'll see what we can do with that as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
And I mean,
Senator Roblin, this is the third time I've heard his presentation, and there's so much in there that we really need to be paying attention to. I mean, it's time to go get outside the box if we're gonna go where we need to go.
Any other comments?
It's amazing. a lot of information to take in.
Yeah. So with that, we have one more presentation. And this is a hard act to follow, so I feel a little bit bad.
Now we're going
to
talk about the testing.
Now we're going back inside the box. So.
So, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for the Oregon Department of Education.
Chair Roblin,
don't quite have enough time, I don't think, but use whatever you have.
I'll start, and we'll see where we get. For the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I've heard Dr. Zhao speak before, and he is a world-class speaker and presenter, and I feel like a crow following a nightingale. But I'll do my best and see if I can also. I didn't bring any pictures of Kim Kardashian in my presentation. I wish I would have remembered to do that.
Thank you for that.
Sometimes I don't. Yeah. And I'll talk a little bit today. My presentation is supposed to be about Assessment 101, which sounds, I know you all are, is certainly as sexy as Kim Kardashian, probably, but certainly not just a very basic kind of topic, and really my presentation is fairly basic, but I do want to talk about a couple of different things. I am struck, you know, every time that I hear Dr. Zhao talk about this country comparison. Because oftentimes I'll have people say to me, gee, you know, Rob, if we just do what they're doing in South Korea, or if we just do what they're doing and name the country, right, put in X for the country, and it would tell you what I hear from people. And I oftentimes want to talk about who we are as a country as compared to other countries when I hear that comparison, and just the richness of culture that we have in this country and diversity around race that really makes us special and different and more creative and more resilient, I think, than other countries across the world, and the level of creativity that infuses into our society, just because we get all the best of all those different components of that. But I also recognize the competitiveness that we bring that I think is really different than a lot of other countries, and part of that's about our form of government, which is the worst form of government except for when you compare it to all the rest. I know you've heard that many a time. And so I just want to really stop and appreciate who we are and why there is a certain uniqueness to our society in general that I think creates some resiliency around some of the very kinds of information that Dr. Zhao talked about. I want to point out, too, that we've set a very special goal in the state of Oregon that's called 40-40-20. And 40-40-20 is an aspirational goal, and it really does demand that if we have any opportunity to even approach 40-40-20, that we have to think about education in a different way than we ever have before. It's part of why we've talked about a continuation or a continuum from birth to graduate school. It also is a goal that if you bring in people who are in workforce in the state of Oregon, they'll sit right here and tell you that we don't need 40-40-20 in order to be successful in our state, that in fact the jobs don't exist support 40-40-20, and honestly they're right, and that's today. If you look at the jobs that we have today, we don't need 40-40-20, but what we do need is 40-40-20 for the jobs of tomorrow. And for us to have the educated kind of populace that it's going to take in order for us to be competitive in a global marketplace. And so I think it is the right goal. It's a good goal, and it's one that we're all, I know you all are committed to, and we're certainly committed to, and we work toward on a daily basis. I do, as I get into this assessment presentation, want to recognize the work that was done by Dr. Nancy Golden and OEA, and that you all have the recommendations around, and then also I think it's a 20-page document that really is a supporting document that goes along with that. I would really encourage you to read it. It's a nice document that talks about assessment, and it doesn't just talk about summative assessment, which is much of what I'm going to talk about today. It really talks about the three appropriate legs of assessment stool: formative, which is something that teachers use on a daily basis to measure and to know what children have learned and how they ought to change instruction so that they make sure that students are learning as much as they intended them to learn and what they intended them to learn on a daily basis. Interim, which is periodic assessment that tells us how our students learning, sort of the aggregate of what we're hoping that they're going to learn. And then summative, which really is a yearly postmortem that says, have they learned sort of the intended target around what was supposed to be learned on a yearly basis. And so I'm going to talk a lot about that, about summative assessment, because I think when we talk about it, oftentimes that's what people are interested in. And so a little bit about those results, standards, some basics around the assessment, and then some specifics about where it is that we're going. One of the things that I do think is important is that in each one of those assessment systems, whether it's interim, formative, or summative, what we're really looking for is a feedback mechanism that tells us what's our next step. What do we do next? How are we doing? And how do we make sure that we are encouraging or improving the amount of learning that takes place on a regular basis? People talk to me about data all the time. They talk to me often about what kind of results that we're able to achieve or not achieve in education in the state of Oregon. 2 years ago, the Northwest Regional Education Lab came out with some data that said in the state of Oregon, 66% of all students who matriculate to a community college within 2 years of graduation from high school will take developmental education courses. They'll take courses that are not college credit bearing, because when they show up and they take an entrance exam, they can't get into a credit bearing course in math, English language arts, or science. 66%. And that if you are in that 66%, this is not in a slide, by the way. I see people looking up at the 68% of reading, and it's not in a slide, but that if you end up in a developmental ed course at the community college level, besides spending tuition money and perhaps grant money or scholarship money on something that doesn't move you towards a college degree as far as credits being earned, that there is a 27% likelihood that you will ever graduate from any college within the next 7 years in our nation with any kind of a degree or certificate. 27% chance. And 66% of our graduates that go to our community college within 2 years end up in that boat. And it's part of the reason that we're not approaching the first or the second 40 as rapidly as we would like to. I also think it's important for you to take a look at this data. This is an assessment fact that, besides the ones that I just shared, that I hear from people regularly. Right now in the state of Oregon, on our third grade assessment that tells us whether or not students are readers by the end of third grade, 68% of our students are reading at grade level, 68%. And if you begin to break that out and you look at Hispanic or Latino, it's 48%, or economically disadvantaged, it's 57%. By the way, just so you know, our four-year cohort graduation rate almost always has mirrored exactly the percentage of students who can read by the end of third grade. Last year, our four-year cohort graduation rate was 68.7%. Our third-grade reading rate was just over 68%. And year in and year out, you're going to see that that more or less is what our result looks like, and that there is a really close correlation with that. I think it's important for us to know that reading is a beautiful thing. And in the information age, the age that we currently live in, if you cannot read, it's almost impossible for you to participate effectively in the age, because you cannot access information in the same way that we expect people to access information. And I would ask you this: how many of you, when you read, have ever had the experience where you're looking at the page and you're busily decoding the words that are on the page, and within a short amount of time, you find that you're beginning to imagine what it is that you're reading? and that you're sort of transported to this different place, where not only you're able to look at the page and start to think about what it is that it's telling you and what the story is, but you start to think about other things. Like, how is this story going to end? How does this relate to something that's happened to me one time in my life? And as you do that reading, you're not really thinking about reading at all, but somehow you're magically able to look on the page, transform those little symbols into something that has meaning in your head, and even think beyond what you're actually reading about other things and tie those things together. And I would submit that to be creative and to really enter into the world in the information age, you need to have that skill. And that it is a kind of cognition that comes with that decoding skill. I would also tell you that really great mathematicians do the exact same thing with math. They begin to look at numbers on a page and they're able to manipulate them in a different way, and pretty soon they're not really looking at numbers on the page, but they're starting to imagine the possible of what those numbers could mean and what they can be. And engineers are really good at that. And those of you who teach math know precisely what I'm talking about, is that you begin to be able to manipulate that in a completely different way. And the truth of the matter is, we must have those basic skills mastered by our students and by our children if we hope to have them enter into the kind of creativity that creates a Google car that can drive without somebody actually navigating the car. And so those are really important concepts. And when I look at this piece of information, it tells me that we need to make some changes and we need to be thinking about literacy and the way that we go about teaching literacy in a different way, because these results are not going to cut it. And they also tell me that we have an achievement gap that we need to attend to. We continue to have a population in the state of Oregon that diversifies. And as it diversifies, if we don't figure out how to close that achievement gap, we have a real issue on our hands. I want you to look at just this little piece of information that tells us about how we're doing over time. If we look at 2008 to 2014 in fifth grade math, you'll see that we have moved the dial, that we've gone from 44% of our students to 60% of our students, an increase of 16%. In eighth grade, we've gone from 51 to 63 in 2008 to 2014. And both of the pieces of data, the previous slide that I showed you, this one and this one, we would not have that data, nor would we want to be thinking about, A, how well are our students doing, or B, are we making progress? We could not answer those questions but for the fact that we have an assessment that helps us know those things. That we are not teaching reading as well as we need to, that we have an achievement gap, and that we are making some progress. Some other things that it tells us are things like this. These are two districts that we chose. I didn't identify them because I didn't necessarily want to put that in the room, but they're District A and District B, and they have nearly identical demographics. And in District A, in third grade reading, 76% of the students are meeting the benchmark, and in District B is 50%. That data is important data for me if I'm a district superintendent or if I'm a deputy superintendent of public instruction, and I would think a policy setter with the state of Oregon, because it tells me that there's something happening here that's different between these two districts, because their kids are virtually the same. What are they doing that's different? What can District B learn from District A? And how can we then work to replicate what District A is doing and even expand on it, because there are some districts that are outperforming District A? We would not know this information or be able to answer this question but for the fact that we do a third grade Oaks assessment in the state of Oregon. This is also District A and District B, the same two districts, and basically what this talks about is what's happened between 2007-08 and 2013-14, and what you'll see is that on math in fifth grade and eighth grade and in reading in third grade, District B, is making little or no progress. Their student growth scores, their student achievement scores are basically stagnant. And that if we go to District A, we see the exact opposite. We see incredible growth, 25 percentage points higher, 18 percentage points higher, and 14 percentage points higher. I know that when we come alongside school districts, and we've begun to do this in the state of Oregon, the Department of Education has begun to identify low-performing schools who are Title I schools and say, it looks like your results are not very good here. Is there a way that we can come alongside you and support you and think about how you might approach this differently. And I can tell you that when we show up at these schools that we call focus and priority schools, and we look at leadership, instruction, pedagogy, that is the way that they're going about instruction and so forth, we see schools, look, by and large, that really do need some support. And that when we begin to support them, their outcomes change. And that we see significant increase. In fact, in our focus and priority schools, and this is a process we've had underway for the last 3 years, roughly 75% of the schools that we've supported have exited focus and priority status, and students are reading and doing math at a much higher level. And it honestly is something that is very recognizable as you come into that kind of a school and look at what's happening and other ways for improvement. I also just will relate to you from my own experience, and sometimes people sort of poke at me about saying this, but I'll say it, and I won't say it very many times or very many places. When I was superintendent in Tiger Tualatin in 2005, 83% of students read at grade level at third grade, and we had a significant achievement gap, nearly 40 percentage points. And we implemented really specific efforts around how we taught, how we were going to coordinate our instruction, and how we were going to support students who were struggling as readers. And by 2013, 93.3% of our third graders were reading at grade level, and we had closed the achievement gap by 20%. And we did it because we had data from assessment that told us that we had work to do, and that there were very specific ways for us to be able to approach that and get at it. And but for the fact that we have a robust assessment system that tells us something about that, we wouldn't necessarily know. So a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of student assessment and accountability in the state of Oregon. Assessments are required by Oregon law and federal law. The state board adopts a set of content standards, that is, the set of information that they're hoping that students will master. And then we also have assessments that assess against that set of standards. So you need to identify what is it you want students to know and be able to do, and then you have an assessment that tells you whether or not they're mastering that set of information and skill. We know that there are several different levels that you can use this data. One of those levels is at the individual student data, and I enter into this with some caution. I won't go out through all the caution, but I can tell you that what we're working on when we have the current set of standards that we have in place is college and career readiness. Is a student ready to go on and be successful either in college or in the workforce? Will the employer say, this student came from school and has the knowledge set and skills that I was looking for in an employee, and they can do a great job here, and with a little bit of help, they'll be wonderful, and that we'll be able to really move forward in our business? Or will this student be able to come to my school and move forward and take credit-bearing courses and not end up in developmental ed and likely not be able to advance their through the education system and move into a place where they have the skill set and the knowledge set and the degree that says that this kind of employment is available for them? And so when a parent gets a score back, and I heard Senator Gelzer talk about this just a little bit, there is a question that we can ask. Is this student on track to be college or career ready? And it is a really hard question. And I would caution parents about drawing too deep of a conclusion. This is one day, one assessment, one snapshot. And there will be more as they move through the school system. But if the answer is no, I want to know that as a parent. If my kids came back and they had the assessment and they said, here's where I'm stacking up on the trajectory of college and career ready, and I didn't think that they were on the trajectory to be college and career ready, I would say that there's something that needs to happen that I need to look at and think about my responsibility, and that I'm going to ask the school to deliver to my child as well. Because not being successful on this assessment is problematic, but not nearly as problematic as having my child show up at college or in the workforce and not having the skill set and the knowledge set to be successful. Because that is a day that is tragic. And so I just want to make sure that we have that. There also is how we're doing as a state that we can determine to some degree around our education system. How is my district doing? How is my school doing? And has a student mastered the essential skills? In the state of Oregon, to get a diploma, you need to be able to demonstrate three different essential skills. I can write, I can read, and I can do math at a level that says I've mastered this set of essential skills, and I can earn an Oregon diploma. Now, Oregon has done a nice job of saying, and it isn't just this single summative assessment on a single day. There are multiple ways that a student can demonstrate that. They can demonstrate it through a series of assessments and classroom work samples. SAT, ACT, Work Keys, Compass, and classroom work samples are all ways that a student can demonstrate the essential skill, as well as the Oregon assessment of knowledge and skills. So student assessments, our assessments in the state of Oregon have been online since 1999. They've been computer adaptive, I think, since 2003. We were the first state in the union that had computer adaptive assessments that were approved by the U.S. Department of Education. And what it really means is that when a student does one question on the assessment, if they get it wrong, they get an easier question on their next effort. And if they get it right, they get a little harder question on their next effort, and it does two things for us. One, it shortens the amount of time that a student needs to take a test and be able to determine what their current skill set is, and it also creates a broader distribution. Instead of having a very narrow measurement set, it lets us extend what we know about what the student does or doesn't know across a broader continuum. In Oregon, the assessment window is open from January through June. On our old assessment system, or really maybe even October through June, where students were able to take multiple assessments on the OAKS, so I could take the reading assessment in October, I could take it again in January, and I could take it again in May if I wanted to. That actually, I think, was a very poor idea. People began to use the assessments inappropriately, trying to measure growth over the course of 1 year, and students took a single assessment as many as three different times. And so as we're moving to our new assessment, the Smarter Balanced Assessment, students will be able to take it once, and the test window is between March and June 12th, so March 1st and June 12th, so we're about to begin that. And I think that that's a really important consideration as we look at that. We also, just so you know, the state of Oregon has a grant and has been charged by the federal government with a $9.1 million grant to create the next English Language Proficiency Assessment, also known as the ELPA, which is an assessment that measures the English language proficiency of students and determines where they are in their acquisition of English language, and that we're leading a 9 or 11 state consortium in putting that work together and making it a better assessment than the one that we currently have and doing some alignment to the Common Core with that. In Oregon, we deliver lots of assessments. And this is part of the issue and part of why you'll see the recommendations that Dr. Golden, OEA, and ODE, myself included, endorse and have participated in the creation of. When you look at the English Language Arts, there are 294,000 students that would take the ELA, English Language Arts Assessment, in Oregon in a given year. And if they took it multiple times, we could get that right up to about 750,000 assessments being delivered if they took it three times. And so we're working to, as I said, reduce that. But those are the different assessments that we give and how many students approximately take them, with, I think, the exception of the social science assessment. That says how many kids there are, but there are only about 25,000 students that actually take that assessment. Oregon law says we need to offer it, but not that anyone needs to take it. Transition to a new system. In 2013, the State Board of Education adopted the Smarter Balanced Assessment. That assessment was field tested last year. I know there have been a lot of concerns about technically can you actually deliver this assessment or not. In Oregon, 24,000 students took it. In California, last spring, every student took it. And it was a really good field test, a really good dry run to see whether or not the delivery system is going to stand up. Across the nation, 4.2 million students took the test, which is a good thing. It gives us a good idea about whether or not we're going to be able to do that, and I believe that we will. In 3rd through 8th and 11th grade, students take the English Language Arts Assessment and also the Math Assessment. And this assessment has multiple choice, short answer, and performance tasks. I put a couple of the test questions in here, and I mostly did that because oftentimes I hear people talk about teaching to the test, and teaching to a test is a bad idea. I completely agree. I will tell you that when you look at the Common Core and the Smarter Balanced Assessment in tandem, I think it's virtually impossible to teach to the test. You can teach to the standards, which if they're really good standards is appropriate, but trying to teach to the test is very, very difficult. This is not a multiple choice assessment. There are different ways to get at this assessment. This is a fifth grade Smarter Balanced English Language Arts item. It talks about hermit crabs. You need to read the passage and scroll down to be able to read the passage. And then there is a question that really asks you to synthesize some of the information that you read in the passage to see what you've been able to glean from that. And it and the fact that it is a synthesis of information and they're asked to provide evidence in the body of what you read, where is your evidence to back up what statements you've made, and that you need to be able to do some argumentation in the answer, is the kind of evidence that you cannot, it's you really cannot teach to this test. It's a different kind of thinking, and it's a deeper kind of learning, and it actually is teaching that you can be more proud of than the kind of teaching that it takes for a student to be successful on a multiple choice test. And then one other one, this is a math test. It is a error math question, again, fifth grade, Smarter Balance, and it really talks about how many buses does a school need to order in order to get six classes to school or to on a field trip on a given day, and then it tells you that there are 26 students in each class and that there is a teacher of each class and that all those people need to go, and do they or don't they have the right number of buses ordered. The thing that is important about this question is it's a demonstration of the kind of way that you would fill out these assessments. So there is a A, B, C, or D selection on this particular one, and I think that C is the one that you would circle where it gives some information or gives you an answer that's not correct. And then it goes down, you can see the three little boxes at the bottom, and it says, well, how many people then really would go on this trip? How many people would you need buses for? And you would need to do the math calculation and then drag the numbers from the left into those boxes to say, this is precisely the number of people who would ride on the buses on the day of the field trip. And so it just is a little bit deeper kind of question than some of the questions that we had, and there also is a math problem work sample that's contained within that. So that's a lot, not nearly as entertaining, no Kim Kardashian, but I hope at least it gave you an assessment 101, and I was fairly blunt about a few different things. I do think it's important for us to recognize that in Oregon, we really have overemphasized this summative assessment leg of the three legs of the assessment stool. We need to trim that one up. We need to focus a little bit more on formative and interim assessment because that's assessment for learning, and summative is assessment of learning, which is a really important distinction. We need to get that balance right, but we also need all three legs of that assessment stool if we're going to do a really good job being informed about how we run a robust education system and to approach 40-40-20 in the state of Oregon. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions. I know time is tight.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. I know that one of your goals in life, Rob, was to follow Young Zhao in the presentation. But I think you did a great job in bringing us back and reminding us of why there is some certain amount, if we do this in a thoughtful, smart way, that this is exactly what we need to keep us on track. And it's actually sort of a mechanism to keep us from going down wrong roads and keeping kids on track. And so I couldn't agree with you more that nobody wants to overtest, nobody wants to undertest. It's just finding that right mix. And with technology available to us today, I think we're in great shape to look at where we need to work on things and where we can continually improve.
Other questions?
Thank you.
I guess from my perspective, I agree. I think when I listen to Zhao and I listen to other things and I think about my experience in school, the goal that I would hope was that we don't take the creativity out of kids,
yeah,
and that we give them opportunities and we put teachers in a place where they can be supportive of kids. And assessment should never be used to judge one kid against another, and that you have to be able to acknowledge the kids came the way they were and that our goal is to help them make choices in their life that will give them more choices in the future. And I think sometimes, you know, I had some successes. I had a lot of failures as a high school math teacher with kids. I had a couple kids who exemplified the confidence. They couldn't do any math problems, but they were really liked math, and they really confident. And eventually, they got really good at it. But they never lost hope or never thought that they were defined by a test or an opportunity. And I think it happens because they allow teachers to make relationships with them to keep encouraging. And I don't want to ever think that we can lose that in this assessment system. And we get so hung up on the assessment system that we all get uptight about it, and that makes the kids more uptight. And I will tell you one thing that I know, and that is if I'm an uptight person trying to learn, I don't do very well.
Right.
If I'm a relaxed human being sitting there, it's the thing I do best. And how we go about doing that as a state is really important. And I do appreciate the stuff, and I do believe that creative thought takes basic information behind it, whether that be reading or whether that be math, because you can't think outside of it without something to think about. But I think we've hurt a lot of kids over the last number of years, personally, with making so much about the outcomes of these tests that they start judging themselves because they have these adults have judged them, so they start making those same assessments about themselves. And when you post anything on the board that indicates a list of how kids are doing or whatever, or anywhere it gets listed, they start doing exactly that because we are a competitive society, and they compare themselves all the time, and that really hurts the next place. So I hope we continue to have that conversation and figure out how to move ourselves forward as a state, because it's really essential. And at the end of the day, I don't know if what we've created with 40-40-20 is the mix that we need for that new society or not. But if we keep the creativity in the kids, they will figure out how to use what they got to do where they want to go and stay out of the basement. I really like the stay out of the basement because many people, that hasn't been our family's deal. My wife wished they came back more often. I mean, when they were gone, they were gone. Yeah. And they've done all sorts of things, and they're all sorts of places, but they certainly haven't.
Don't take
back.
That personally. By
I know. We don't. They tell us they still, appreciate us. But, I stayed in my house for longer to go to community college. They didn't know. We had a great time. Thanks. It was good, but we're off. And it is a measure of some success. And I think there's a lot of people out there that wish that was happening for them. And I do think you did a great job following up with the assessment kinds of issues. And I have to think about Kardashian a lot because there's obviously a skill there that I had never identified because she was not one of my people. And then when he says $40 million, I'm thinking, oh my word. His assessment of what she has done to get there was, I thought, right.
Plastic
on.
Surgery.
It was just strange to me to see that idea of really tipping on our head what our society values and are we preparing kids for some of the things that may be out there. It's weird. So with that, any other comments from our class that want to get themselves like I did? Into a place like that? any other last thing? Okay.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah.
So we actually made this one within our time limit. I'm impressed. I have nothing else to come except one more announcement to state that if you are interested in being in a discussion with regard to OEIB in the future, please let our administrator know. That's people outside of this room as well as inside the room. Because in the very short period of time, we will start pulling that group together to start having a conversation of what I think we need to do and what I think as a group we believe we need to do. So with that, I'll close that public hearing, and then I will close our Senate Education Committee for February 10th, 2015.
Arnie, I might have an idea or two.
How much of that?
Arnie, I might have an idea or two.